Next week, my family's coming down from South Carolina, and we'll be making the obligatory pilgrimage to a theme park next week. Maybe some of you all have that experience. So welcome to Orlando, the hospitality capital of the world, where everyone's a guest and from someplace else and made to feel at home. A few years ago, I heard a news story that one of the area theme parks, Universal Studios, was up for sale. I thought, we should buy it. Think about it. With some minor tweaks, we could buy it and turn it into Universalist Studios. It could still have rides and experiences based on movies, but now they'd be based on Ken Burns specials and PBS documentaries. Other rides might include Snow White and the Seven Principles. The I've Been to the Mountaintop roller coaster. There'd be a world religions world divided into various Holy Land experiences, one for each major religion, letting parkgoers enjoy a vast array of spiritual traditions and take part in all the different rituals. An interactive wax museum would feature likenesses of our historic religious heretics and social justice leaders. At Universalist Studios, meals would be organic potluck. At the end of each evening, all the guests would be welcome to join the fair wage workers in marching in a solar light parade. And at Universalist Studios, one out of every 10 days would be gay days. I thought this was brilliant. But every time I shared the idea with a fellow Unitarian Universalist, they were horrified. Well, here's my unscientific, uncensored, predisposed judgments on why. Three reasons. One, Unitarian Universalism would reemerge as a very well-known religion here and worldwide. Two, we'd be financially viable. And three, this Orlando church in particular, the membership would explode. Yikes! How scary! Membership wouldn't explode from anything like evangelism. We are not about converting anyone. But there would no longer be such a thing as a person who's Unitarian Universalist and doesn't know it yet. Raise your hand if you've ever said or thought, I love this place, this is where I belong, and I'd have been here sooner if I'd have known about it. Wow. I think that's kind of a shame. I hear that phrase a lot from guests and fellow members, and it makes me a little sad they didn't find this place sooner. I know a little bit about not finding your spiritual center or truest self until later in life, and I can't help but think sometimes, if only, I wonder. I wish I'd known y'all sooner. But once we finally find this place, we are perhaps a little bit like the classic caricature of the Florida transplant. Now that I'm here, Katie bar the door. It's too much traffic. The rest of you guys is just stay up there, where the tomatoes grow better anyway, right? But I mean, that's not like us. We are very inclusive. We're even a pro-immigration faith. We UUs are in Arizona right now and everywhere else, fighting for the rights of immigrants. And this very church did the hard work years ago of meeting a list of requirements in order to earn the UUA designation of a welcoming congregation to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered individuals, right? But now that we've finally found our home, we are understandably rather protective of it. Don't want it messed with, because we love this place. I love this place so much, I moved next door. The very first week I moved in, I was in my backyard one night when a car pulled into the parking lot, the church parking lot, Two guys get out of the car and start hollering and fighting and cussing. I got so protective. Without any sense, I marched over the fence with my phone and my flashlight, and I shined it in their eyes, and I said, "Hey, what do you guys think you're doing cussing in my damn church parking lot?" As they were leaving, did I say, "And by the way, services are at 10:45 on Sundays." I sort of forgot that part. We don't have to be obnoxiously overprotective to be unwelcoming. All we have to do is just not think about it. I'm great at not thinking about it. Somehow my DNA skipped over the hospitality gene, or my mama just didn't raise me right, I don't know. It just doesn't come naturally for me like it does for some. If you happen to come to our house and knock on the door, hope and pray that Rachel will answer the door. She'll likely greet you with a warm hug, pull you inside, sit you down, fix you a refreshing beverage with fresh mint from our backyard, fling open the refrigerator and spread you a buffet, ask about your mother, make an appointment to have lunch with your mother next week, personally check your car's tire pressure for safety before she lets you go, with a few borrowed books and fresh-cut flowers. That's just how she is. If you come to our house and I hear you knock on the door, I might look around and go, "You want me to get that?" If I do open the door, I'll likely stand in the doorway for 10 minutes, chatting you up about my day before it occurs to me to ask about yours, much less invite you in. Makes me mad, but hospitality just isn't one of my given strengths. But it is very important to me, so I am working to make it a core part of my personal spiritual practice. For me, the spiritual work of warm welcome and what we call radical hospitality is difficult, it's humbling, and it's rewarding. Whenever I'm being mindful of other people, I'm so much more aware and appreciative of all the niceness and abundance that surrounds me, and I'm less aware of my own perceived problems and shortcomings. Becoming more aware of the needs of other individuals even makes me feel like I might somehow be closer to solutions of the world's needs. There are two things close to home that help bring me to this desire to be more mindful, accommodating, and even radically welcoming here at this church. About 12 years ago, a member here named Rose Justice, who as a short person is a little under 4 feet tall, pointed out to me that the light switch in the women's bathroom in Gore Hall is positioned too high for her to reach. She was patient and kind and asking for my help, but I felt awful and immediately thought too of all the young girls who aren't tall enough either yet to turn the light on, to go to the bathroom by themselves. I felt terrible. I never thought of that before. And then about 2 years ago, back when we still all sat down at tables during social hour, a friend pointed out to me that there's no proper place for our small children to sit, and that they always wound up sitting and eating on the stage floor, which, besides being uncomfortable, isn't the cleanest place to eat. I'd seen kids sitting there doing that every Sunday for 12 years, and I never thought of that. I'm a sufficient enough 5'4" tall, and I don't have any kids. So these things weren't obvious to me, and I hadn't bothered to notice. But whenever it's me, I feel the rude rejection of, say, someone not holding the door open for me when my arms are full, or the righteous indignation that creeps in when someone refers to my sexual orientation as my lifestyle. I remember those two instances. Take a breath. Cool out, and think, you know, they don't know. They're on their path too. And maybe I can offer them some perspective from a place of love and hope rather than of anger. I'm liable to get carried away here and think these small instances of righteous indignation and hurt can somehow turn into insults, blowouts, and full-scale wars, and such small, subtle shifts in attitude to a little more tolerant and understanding, to acceptance and welcoming, might just lead to full-scale, all-out peace. I love us. I think our beloved community is extremely mindful, friendly, a welcoming bunch. But I think maybe if we open up a little more to what it might be like for others who are shorter or younger, darker or lighter, newer or other, we could enjoy an expanded, broader community of others who still we share a lot in common with, and we wouldn't have to feel so different or minority or fringe or small or underdog all the time, so isolated, so 3% of or 1 in 10 of. I invite you to open your minds and close your eyes. Come with me on a short guided tour. Imagine you've never been to the First Unitarian Church of Orlando before today. So you're new here. Had you heard much about Unitarian Universalism in the past? What was your perception of it? Did you take a test on BeliefNet? Did you hear a recent sermon online so you could test the water and see a little of what we're about before you got here? Was it our visibility in the community that led you here? Did a friend or acquaintance invite you? If so, did you think they were a crazy evangelist? How did you find this place? When you got here, was it obvious this was the place? Was there clear signage? Did you find a parking space okay? In your mind's eye, take a look around. What'd you notice about the grounds, the buildings, the people? Did you know where the sanctuary doors were? Did you have any trouble finding a place to sit somewhere close to the back door in case this place freaked you out and you needed a quick getaway? An aisle seat where you had easy access to the bathroom and the wiggle room. Did anyone speak to you or greet you? If so, how was that? Are you more comfortable now than when you first got here? When you leave here today, will you come back? Okay, those of us who've been around a while can easily take for granted what goes on around here, how things work, and who's who. But even though the First Unitarian Church of Orlando is a 98-year-old entity, most of us didn't grow up in this church. And not so long ago, we were brand new too, strangers looking for spiritual hospitality, fellowship, and safe harbor. In fact, not only are most of us not originally from this church, I recently learned that I'm only about one of 3% of us who are from Central Florida. It took me forever to understand why, ever since I moved to Orlando from just 40 minutes away, everyone I meet, their first question is, "Where are you from?" I finally realized it's because nobody's from here. So I have to ask, "Where are y'all from?" I have a personal theory that there are three stages of existence at this church, or three I know of so far. The first stage is the guest, which most of us have been, right? This place starts out as a spiritual truck stop. We're just here to get fed. And that's okay. That's what guests are supposed to do. Take advantage of our hospitality and what we have to offer. Be our guest. Then there's the second stage. You've been a recurring guest for a while now, and one day you're waiting in line to help yourself to coffee at social hour, when up ahead, you notice that all three pitchers of lemonade are drained empty. And without thinking about it, you cut in front of the line. You grab the pitchers. You make your way to the kitchen. Feel your way around to find the lemonade mix. Discover one used great ice maker. And as you make your way back out to the table, balancing three full pitchers of cold lemonade, you suddenly feel the full weight in your hands of the responsibility you've just taken on. And bam, just like that, you're hooked. You care. You're no longer a guest. Now you've taken ownership. Congratulations, you've just gone from the guest stage to owner. You own the place. You start looking around and seeing all kinds of unmet potential here and ask, why hasn't this or that been done yet? And while that immediately gets you appointed chair of that committee, and you're moving and you're shaking and you're making things happen because you own the place. It's a little frustrating at times, but for the most part, it feels great. But if you're lucky, you get to the third stage. It may go something like this. Someone else, in their great ownership stage, gets an idea and brings their skill and insight to the table, and they change something without asking you. Or maybe you were there for the proposal, but you didn't vote for it. Yet here it is, anyway, a brand new, totally different logo and colors you, as an owner, never would have picked. Or someone gets the wacky idea to just up and nix the very fine, built-in, 20-year-old choir loft and build a new one over here, smack dab in the middle of the pulpit area. Just slice up the stage. Hand-build and hand-stain risers and have the nerve to put them right here in front of God and everyone. Of all the nerve. Don't they understand? You are an owner and you don't approve. But then the choir gets up and sings. They sound good. Their faces look happy. Maybe, even though it's not what you would have done or even had the time to do, you decide to trust the other and the otherness, since it turned out not to mean the end of the world. And imagine it may be even a good thing that someone else did. You've just risen to the third stage, going from owner to belonging. The stage where you realize you're glad you're part of something bigger, bigger than yourself, part of something that will always have something or someone new to offer for your own and the greater good. And you can feel good knowing that in the process, surely somebody new joined in, a guest, picked up a hammer or some stain to help build the choir risers. And they, in that moment, went from guest to owner. This is a place of fellowship, spiritual mingling, communal belonging. A place that today was the one you sought out to nurture your spirit. For many of us, it's the one you know will welcome your ongoing spiritual journey, the one you come to for encouragement to take your values and put them into action, the one you share with others, some you know, some you don't, and yet in common have been invited to come to call home. May we all welcome with purposeful, warm hospitality each other as guests on this earth. Welcome each other as owners of our hearts and spiritual paths, and as belongers who inevitably have so much to offer that our circle ever widens, our light farther shines, such that each day there's one less they and one more we.